The ABC Radio Network brings you the recorded highlights of a significant news conference conducted today by Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. This is Bill Downs reporting. Secretary McNamara summoned reporters to the Pentagon today primarily to talk about the more than $4.5 billion in savings to the taxpayer through the Defense Department's revolutionary cost reduction program. In fact, so startling have been the results of what is called McNamara's management revolution at the Pentagon that President Johnson has recommended every other department and agency in his administration to study the Defense Secretary's methods and go and do likewise. Mr. Johnson also suggested that Mr. McNamara explain the cost-slashing system to the news media. However, the reporters today were more interested in Secretary McNamara's trip to Saigon and the escalation of the war in Vietnam. Also, a report was circulating that the armed services already had drawn up a proposal to call up some 200,000 men from the National Guard and the Ready Reserves. The tentative proposal reportedly would include 120,000 guardsmen and reservists for the Army, 40,000 for the Navy, 20,000 men for the Air Forces, while the U.S. Marines reportedly wants a call-up of the 4th Marine Division and its air wing, which totals about 44,000 men. Secretary McNamara did not get that specific, but he confirmed that the war in Vietnam was now out of the vest pocket class, and he warned Americans that they should be prepared for greater sacrifices.
You said at the start of this that you doubted very much that everything would be equal in the coming year. That means that you feel the cost of the war in Vietnam is bound to go up because of the situation.
Well, as the President has indicated, I'm leaving for South Vietnam tonight. General Wheeler, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, is accompanying me, as is Ambassador Lodge. One of the main purposes of my trip is to review the force levels planned for South Vietnam, number of U.S. troops to be assigned there, the equipment required, the expected consumption of munitions and other products. What the decisions will be based upon this review, I can't say. But I do draw your attention to the fact that the Viet Cong are continuing to increase their forces in South Vietnam, that as we've reported to you on previous occasions, they currently have in that country forces not yet assigned to combat, that the level of operation and the intensity of operation during the summer has increased, as we predicted it would, that we can expect further increases in the Viet Cong operations because of the likely commitment of forces not yet committed to combat. All of these circumstances affect our force levels. If the forces assigned to Southeast Asia are increased, almost surely this will require additions to the fiscal 66 budget. Yes.
Mr. Secretary, there have been a number of reports and rumors and what have you regarding increased draft calls or limited call-ups of reserves and so forth. Could you address yourself to that?
The President alluded to this yesterday in his press conference. I don't have anything to add to what he said. It is, I think, reasonable to assume that if the U.S. forces assigned to South Vietnam or to Southeast Asia increase in strength, it will be necessary to consider calling up reserve and guard forces, extending the tours of duty of personnel presently in the forces, and increasing the draft calls.
Secretary, yes. How would you describe in military terms the present state of relationship between North Vietnam and the United States in Vietnam? Is this war, undeclared war, hostility, undeclared war?
Well, I don't wish to engage in a legal discussion. I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's very clear what's happening. The North Vietnamese have publicly and otherwise indicated their plan to subvert the political institutions of South Vietnam, to achieve domination over those political institutions, to supply whatever materiel and personnel assistance is required. Last night I was looking over some of the public statements, and I think you might be interested in them. In 1960, at the Third Congress of the North Vietnamese Communist Party, Ho Chi Minh had this to say: "It is absolutely essential for North Vietnam to step up the National Democratic People's Revolution in the South. And in March of 1963, the Communist Party Journal of North Vietnam, Huktap, frankly stated that the government in South Vietnam is well aware that North Vietnam is the firm base for the Southern Revolution. And there are page after page after page of quotations of this kind, frankly asserting the responsibility of North Vietnam for the insurgency action in the South, frankly stating it is their objective to supply whatever men, whatever equipment is required to successfully carry out that revolution to subvert the institutions of the South and achieve domination over the people of the South.
Secretary, what has been your method of increasing the size of our forces in South Vietnam? Have you set out with an approximate sense of the need earlier this year and then moved them in as long as that seemed to be justified, or have you actually, in the way that we've been getting the news, 10,000 here, 15,000 there, discovered the need in those terms?
Well, a little of both, I think. The situation is changing, and as it changes, we must change our plans. At any given time, we assign forces to South Vietnam in relation to a military plan that's been established and approved by the appropriate constitutional authorities. And that plan remains in effect, and we supply forces in accordance with it until the situation changes. Changes in the situation are beyond our control. What action the North Vietnamese will take in accordance with these statements I've just read to you, I can't predict. All I can say is that at any particular time we'll have a plan to respond to our best estimate of their actions, and we'll modify that plan when we see indications that they are changing their own plans.
Have you issued any instructions yet for any Guard or Reserve officials to begin preparations for call-up?
No, I have not. Although I want to point out that over the past 3 years, one of our primary objectives has been to increase the combat readiness of both the active forces and the reserve and guard forces, and much has been done to do that, so that the action taken to call up a reserve and guard unit today would yield a far more active unit, a far more combat-ready unit than was the case during the last major call-up in the fall of 1961. And while we're speaking of combat readiness, perhaps I should tell you that today the stocks of modern bombs are some 500% greater than they were 4 years ago. I'm speaking now of modern high explosive bombs. And the bombs on order from past year's appropriations now flowing into the inventories will, even at consumption rates substantially higher than we are presently realizing, about double that inventory in the next 10 or 11 months. So by the end of fiscal 1966, our stocks of modern bombs will be about 1,000% higher than they were in mid-1961. And also, while I'm commenting on combat readiness, I should tell you I think that we're considering a 50% increase in the number of helicopter companies in the Army. And we've already substantially increased helicopter production, increasing the production of the Iroquois model by about 60%, and the production of the Chinook by about 100%. These production increases, of course, will not take place overnight. We'll achieve the full 60% increase in the Iroquois production by the spring of next year, and the Chinook roughly the same time. These are increases not required to offset combat losses, which, as a matter of fact, have been very low. The loss rate in the helicopters is about one helicopter per 10,000 sorties, which is a fantastically low loss rate. The increases, in contrast to that, are the result of a recognition of the need for increasing mobility of both our Marine ground forces and our Army ground forces. Increasing mobility being a method to vastly increase the effectiveness of the individual soldier.
Mr. Secretary, yes. Is our operation in Vietnam still primarily a counterinsurgency operation, or is it gradually being converted into a conventional war?
Well, these are questions of semantics. I think what's happening out there is very clear to you. There are 65,000 what we call regular guerrillas and about 80 to 100,000 irregulars for a total guerrilla force of about 165,000, which, because of its size, is attacking in larger and larger concentrations. Now, whether you call those guerrillas or semi-conventional, I don't know. As I say, I think it's a question of semantics. But the number of battalion-sized operations is increasing. The duration of them is increasing. The intensity of the attack is increasing. And this requires that we change the tactic by which we respond to those operations.
Yes. Sir, do you feel that you're not getting correct or full enough information from the people in Vietnam? I'm not clear on why you're making this trip.
There's no substitute for personal confrontation, as I think is demonstrated by the fact that 100 of you came out here today to talk to me. Yes?
If you merge the Guard and the Reserves, you're probably going to get less reserve officers, at least you're going to get some degree of, maybe, as you say, more coordination of the numbers of reserves. But you're talking about calling up your reserves and guardsmen. Isn't that meaning that you're going to need all the reserves and guardsmen you can? So are you going to stop your plans for merging of the Guard and Reserve?
No, the reorganization of the Reserve and Guard, which some of the steps of which have been completed in relation to prior year's plans and some others of which we are currently discussing with the Congress, has been directed to increasing the combat readiness of the Reserve and Guard, and has been directed to balancing the number of men with our war plans and with our equipment levels. As I think I reported to you previously, we have Reserve and Guard organizations for which there is no requirement in the war plans, and in particular for which there is no equipment available, and for which none should be procured. And I think it's quite illogical and unreasonable to continue the use of such organizations in the Reserve and Guard. Many of them are associated with antiquated weapons no longer in the inventory. Many of them have skills associated with obsolete equipment, skills which obviously are not required. So there is no contradiction between a possible call-up of the Reserve and Guard on the one hand, and a further reorganization of it to increase the combat readiness of the remaining units on the other.
You'll go ahead with your plans on that?
We are continuing to discuss the plans with the Congress, and the action that will be taken, I think, will depend upon further action by the Congress. Yes?
Secretary, how much larger of an increase would you have in South Vietnam before you seriously considered calling it?
I don't wish to try to estimate or predict that to you today. Two more questions. Yes,
please. President Johnson said yesterday that General Westmoreland could now use the U.S. forces over there in the way he thought they could be used most effectively. Does this reflect a change in the control pattern?
Has he been
given more authority over his forces?
No. The U.S. forces in South Vietnam have been under the command of U.S. officers and will continue to be under the command of U.S. officers. When operating in association with the South Vietnamese, the command arrangements will be developed in such a way as to allow the South Vietnamese to function under their commanding officers and the U.S. personnel to function under ours. There will be joint command relationships and procedures to ensure proper coordination at the interface. One more question, gentlemen.
Secretary, you've spoken about the changing plans, the changing strength of the Vietnamese, and our plans being changed to meet them. Do we have any plans at all to take the initiative and get this thing in a more manageable form?
The question is, do we have any plans to take the initiative and get the operations into what was termed to be more manageable form? We have stated time and time again that our objective in Southeast Asia is a limited one. We are not seeking to destroy the people or the government of North Vietnam. We're not seeking to obtain military bases on the soil of South Vietnam. We're not seeking to develop an alliance with South Vietnam to introduce it into a relationship, a military relationship, with nations of the West. We are seeking to ensure that the people of that country will have control of their own destiny and can develop politically, economically, and socially as they choose. And our action is taken to achieve that end. The primary responsibility for achieving it must, of course, be the South Vietnamese. We are there to assist them. We are there at their request. As President Johnson emphasized yesterday, three American presidents have committed us to that policy, and we propose to continue it.
The worrisome news of Vietnam overshadowed Secretary McNamara's good news about reducing defense costs to the American taxpayer. However, in the long run, many private economists and government experts say that the so-called management revolution in the Defense Department is one of the most important achievements of federal government administration to come along in this century. Here, Mr. McNamara explains what he's been doing out there at the Pentagon.
Last evening, I received the near final estimate for the Department of Defense expenditures in fiscal year 1965, the year which ended June 30th. These expenditures total approximately $47.5 billion. That's $3.75 billion less than we estimated when the budget was submitted to Congress over a year ago. A major factor contributing to this $3.75 billion saving has been the Defense Department's cost reduction program. I submitted my annual report on that subject to the President Monday of this week. He has asked that we distribute it to governors, mayors, presidents of corporations, unions, trade associations, chambers of commerce, and other organizations which have contributed so much to that report. And he particularly asked that I present it to you today, and this I will do. You'll recall that this program started almost 4 years ago, and in 1962, we reported that we were setting up a five-year program which we hope would yield annual savings of about $3.1 billion per year by 1967, with savings of some $750 million in the first year of the program, 1962. 1 year after the start of that project, in mid-1963, we reported upon progress at that time. The program had exceeded our expectations, and because of that, we were able to raise the end objective by about $1 billion, setting a new target for 1967 and each year thereafter of $4 billion of savings. Again, a year ago, in 1964, we reported to the President upon the progress in 1964, which exceeded our goals again. And extending that progress into the future, we raised the goal by about $500 million, making it $4.6 billion. And now this year, we find that the progress in the past 12 months has been substantially better than we predicted. We estimated the savings through efficiency increases alone would amount to about $2.5 billion. They're more than $2 billion higher, totaling $4.6 billion for fiscal 1965. And for that reason, we have increased the end goal of the program from an annual saving of $4.5 billion, which was the goal last year, to something in excess of $6 billion at this time. I want to summarize for you very quickly the sources of these savings and then respond to your questions. The efficiency increases derive from three basic parts of the program: from buying only what we need, from buying that at the lowest sound cost, and from reducing operating costs. Under buying only what we need, we have refined our requirements calculations to avoid buying materiel that is not justified by military requirements, to avoid buying in excess of those requirements. We've increased the use of excess inventory, and I should tell you we have today in our stocks about $10 billion worth of material not required. And we're seeking to utilize that material instead of selling it for scrap at about 7 cents on the dollar. We have eliminated gold plating, and by that we mean we've eliminated those specifications which add to cost but which do not increase military utility. We've reduced the number of items in the inventory, reducing our carrying charges. Now, I'll cite briefly illustrations of each of these. One of the most important actions taken to refine requirements is illustrated by this Minuteman missile part. This is the guidance system of the Minuteman missile. It must be replaced periodically. It has been our custom to maintain, for such high cost items, a 62 days inventory supply. In this instance, we placed that requirement on order. We subsequently calculated, however, that by careful control of transportation and the repair cycle, we could eliminate about 45 days of that 62-day supply. We canceled the order for 32 of these components, at a price of $900,000 apiece, and we've saved, therefore, in fiscal 65, about $28.5 million through this single action alone. As an illustration of the use of excess inventory, on which we saved about $80 million in 1965, you can look at this 90-millimeter tank ammunition cartridge. Here we were buying some 500,000 cartridge cases for target practice rounds. They were costing $5.90 a piece. We placed the contract, but after placing the contract, by screening our excess inventory, which, as I said, amounts to about $10 billion worth of material today, we located this cartridge for an obsolete piece of munition for the T-91. And by reworking it at a cost of 29 cents, which includes the cancellation cost on the new contract, we made it possible to use it for the M-108. We saved $3 million, something on the order of $5.50 per cartridge. As an illustration of refining the specifications to eliminate unnecessary characteristics, to simplify the design, to ensure they're directly related to military utility, what we call eliminating gold plating, there are several interesting examples. Here's a cartridge case. Before redesign, it had six parts. We simplified the design, cut them in half, reduced the price by more than half, and on that single item saved about $1 million in fiscal 1965. In this missile storage case for the Tartar and Terrier missiles, we had been buying one case for every missile, about $2,000 a piece. We found that we could redesign it, reduce the cost to $250 for storage, saved on that single item $1,200,000 during the year. And on this circuit board, which you can just barely see at the bottom of the set of charts, we had been soldering it with gold and silver solder. We changed that to 10 in lead, saved $200,000, but in that particular instance, even more importantly, increased the reliability of the board itself. So much then for buying only what we need. The next category of action is headed buying at the lowest sound price. I think we've reported to you before the series of actions that we are taking to accomplish this. They fall under four headings. First, we are shifting from non-competitive to competitive procurement. Secondly, we're shifting from cost-plus contracts to fixed price or price incentive contracts. Thirdly, we're procuring where possible directly from the manufacturer instead of through a middleman. And fourthly, we're consolidating more than 1 year's procurement and placing it on contract at a single time. In 1961, about 33% of our contracts were let competitively. We've established a goal of raising that to 40%. The reason is very clear. Because of the pressure of competition, we save about 20 cents or 25 cents on every dollar placed competitively compared to a non-competitive procurement. You can see the performance against that goal. In 1965, the objective was about 40%. We realized for the first 9 months of the fiscal year, the latest period for which we have information, about 44%. The result is we shifted $2.2 billion of contracts from non-competitive to competitive procurement. We estimate we saved 25 cents on each dollar shifted, so the saving included in the report is $550 million.
ABC Radio has brought you the recorded highlights of a news conference held today by Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, who left this evening with Ambassador-designate Henry Cabot Lodge and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Earl Wheeler, for a fact-finding mission to Saigon in Vietnam. This is Bill Downs, ABC Washington.
For good listening, keep listening to the ABC Radio Network.